rte.ie/drama-on-1.
Now, In the Wings, a programme where artists talk about their work and their journey towards performance. Tonight, director Jessica Drumgool and actors Tadhg Murphy and Ronan Leahy talk about The Last Room by J.P. McMahon, which took third prize at the 2024 PJ O'Connor Awards and is next week's Drama on One.
My name's Jessica Drumgool.
My name is Ronan Leahy.
Hello, my name is Tadhg Murphy.
And the play is The Last Room by J.P. McMahon.
I'm playing the role of Paul.
I play Adam.
I came across the play first judging for the PJ O'Connor Award, and I think really you're looking for scripts that are as different as possible from each other, and then you start looking for the qualities. And this one stood out, not necessarily as a piece that I understood fully how to make, but as something that really fascinated me. And I think, I hope, it's that puzzle is still quite dynamic in it. And then, of course, there's a lot of humanity too. If there wasn't humanity, if there was only a puzzle, we wouldn't be talking now.
Paul is an inquisitive type. He's a bit suspicious. He's not quite sure what he's doing in this reality, so he's fishing for any information he can get. So I would say he's an inquisitive person.
The character Adam is one of two characters, Adam and Paul. And Adam is searching, and it's very hard to talk about without giving some of the conceits away within the structure of the piece. But Adam is wanting to get away from everything, we think, and is searching for answers.
The play is about two men who find themselves in a space where they're not quite sure how to potentially get out of this space. It's very Beckettian. I can't say too much because I would give it away, but it's an existential play that speaks, I think, to what it's like to be alive in the world today.
Myself and Ronan were discussing the fact that it's Adam and Paul, and you can't help but think of Mark O'Halloran and the late Tom Murphy when you're reading it. I suppose there's a closeness about these characters that's echoed.
My initial impression was that it was, as I said, Beckettian. I thought of Severance, the TV show, and I also thought of Squid Games. Severance because of the architecture of the world that JP has created. And I don't know if you've seen Severance, but it's very much like, reminds me of the numbskulls from, I think it was the Beano, where they're inside the guy's head. And Squid Games because of the nature of the tasks they have to perform to proceed in the game. That's kind of going on in this story too.
I remember rehearsing with Mark in, I think it was the team office just across from the Abbey when he was writing Adam and Paul. And we used to look down, there was a centre for heroin addicts there. So we used to look down and, you know, we'd be observing whatever. Little did I know that how Mark was observing. Yeah, not until I saw the film, which is just so beautiful. Lenny did such a good job and so did the two boys were just amazing. And it's such a wonderful thing to have because I miss Tom terribly. So being able to go back and watch that is like revisiting Tom.
So The Last Room is a room in a scheme of rooms, and the two characters, Adam and Paul, are hoping it's the last room and also dreading that it might be the last room. I don't want to put too much of an interpretation on it because you believe what you want about the last room. But if you thought it might be a purgatorial scheme, this would be the place of final reckoning. But it's much more playful than that. And it's more about a series of challenges and games and the hope that meaning will come through. And so I think this is the last room because the meaning emerges for the two characters of what they're doing.
When I get a script, I will read it in silence. I won't try and read my lines out or see what it... So it's about how it makes me feel. And the first thing I would go always to is the story. What's the story being told? And what's my role within that story? Yeah, I'd probably read it over and over and over for a week and eventually maybe start reading it out loud. I think because the text is the first port of call for an actor to get the lines in without even making sense of them, to say them out loud, it gets into the body, it gets into the mouth, it gets into the muscles. So it's a good way of not intellectualising the script, but just the sounds of the words.
I think the uncertainty is the best thing about it. I think if you are not looking forward to growing a little with every project you work on, you get very stuck very quickly. And also, of course, the form is growing all the time. These are people who are hugely influenced by other artists, but bring a lot more of themselves in, possibly than they even know. And I think that that's the delight of it. If somebody, it's Burkettian, I think everyone has said it's Burkettian. And if someone was trying to do something that's Burkettian and doing it quite well, it wouldn't be as interesting as this. It's got a lot of JP in it, which is what makes it so, frightening and exciting to work on. I never sleep well the night before studio, and I also vomit the morning before studio. And I was saying this the other day in Albania at a meeting of European producers, and it's so interesting. The room was divided into people who slept incredibly well, but whose engineers didn't. And people who slept incredibly badly, whose engineers were very relaxed. And I think one of the two, you have to, someone has to take the bullet, yeah.
A significant artistic influence on my life. This is tricky because it was a cultural moment in Ireland where there was a thing called the moving statue. And I remember we were driving down to Cork and we decided to detour and go and see this thing. There were so many people looking at this statue that did not move. And I was a child and, you know, children do this where you go, I've seen it move, I saw it move, I saw it move. All that. But there were adults around me crying and laughing and having all sorts of different experiences staring at this inanimate object. And I found that, even as a child, just so incredible that people could all stare the same way at one thing and imagine another world that doesn't exist. So that moment had a profound effect on me. It opened up the possibility of the other not necessarily being what you see.
I remember going on a school trip to see Jonathan Pryce and Sinead Cusack in Macbeth. It was 1987 and it was directed by Adrian Noble. And that had a huge effect on me. That was in Stratford-upon-Avon. When I walked into the theatre, I was overwhelmed. I hadn't really been to something that grand before. And I was shocked by the modernity of it. They were wearing Aran jumpers and kind of modern dress. And again, I had never thought that you could do something like this. It could have such an immediate, visceral effect on me watching the drama. I was very aware that Sinead Cusack was an Irish woman and I'm a huge fan of her work anyway. She's magnificent. But in this, she just burned up the stage and I was very proud that she was in it and Irish.
Everyone has a different experience in the theatre, but they are all witnessing a similar expression. So the ability to interpret uniquely what is you through somebody else's offering.
I'm ridiculously fortunate in having the friendship and patronage of Maeve Binchy in my life. And she came into our family, she burst into our family with so much love and energy and generosity, but she also enabled me hugely to think of myself as a creator and an artist, and she pushed and pushed me against the natural resistance of childhood until I admitted it to myself. And I honestly think it's it made all the difference. Also, of course, I read her work knowing her and made that connection between the artist and the art in a very privileged way and saw quite how possible it could be. So that's been the biggest influence in my life, I'm delighted to say.
100%, without a doubt, has shaped an awful lot of what I do. And what I'm interested in is Enda Walsh, for absolutely certain. I did a play in, I think, around 2008, 2009, called The Walworth Farce. And that was a huge shift. I think that's what kept me following the path that I'm on, because I worked so hard in that play. Michael Murphy directed it, and Garrett Lumbert and Dennis Conway and myself touring, and Mercy O'Gillady. And I saw a lot of the world while doing that play. And I also had a very unique look where the top of my head was shaved, and I had long hair back and sides, and I was playing a very unique character. So it was such an extraordinary time in my life. So much was changing, and that was all under the umbrella of Enda himself. And then I continued to work with him for the next, well, hopefully forever, you know.
A significant person in my early life was Neville Carlyle Style. Neville is a South African theatre director and musical theatre director. And he was the director of the course that I went to in Bull Alley. And Neville was a very talented director. He was very honest about your work. And he really encouraged me and pushed me out of my comfort zone. He made me sing in the musical The Fantastics. He cast me as the lead, which was totally out of my comfort zone. But he would do things like this to really challenge you. And I really respected him for that. And we're still friends.
I think you could track my life through the books I've read. I think everyone who works in audio drama has an immersive prone sensibility. So the deeper you can get into a story in a world, the happier you are. And about 15, 20 years ago, Life After Life by Kate Atkinson became the controlling book of my life, because she wrangles stories so incredibly. She challenges form so fantastically. And she writes the tiny details of life while at the same time being this assassin of her characters. I mean, the number of deaths in Kate Atkinson that she takes very seriously but also feels this enormous facility with is so exciting. And I know that I spent a long period of my life hugely influenced by South American magical realism and Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude. I could still quote huge passages of, because was massive for me. Once I like a book, I read it over and over, and that's that means I haven't read many books, but I have read books many times.
My earliest cultural memory is going to see Jack and the Beanstalk in Drogheda with my dad. I must have been maybe 5 or 6, and my second one was I went to see Gulliver's Travels on my own with Richard Harris in the lead role. And I was 7 years old, and I was allowed to go to the cinema on my own because my dad worked in the town. So, and that had a huge effect on me as well.
Yes, I think the book that inspired me the most was, I mean, I'm thinking back to being a child, so anything Roald Dahl. George's Marvelous Medicine was the first book I ever read. And I remember reading it on the landing in the house, lying down, and just absolutely being in that world. And time not being a thing. It was like, you know, we had a black and white TV as a kid. So this was like being in Technicolor in my own imagination. And it was such a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I ended up reading all of that stuff. So as an adult, sort of, I always have like 4 or 5 books at the same time. And I never finish them. I never have time with 2 kids. But I read a lot when I'm away. If I'm working, I finish books when I'm working. If I'm away from the kids, or if I'm in London, I tend to read books on the tube.
Oh, I was awful in school. I never, ever caught the eye of an adult. So I only considered myself one of my friendship set. I never listened to teachers, never looked at teachers, never took any notice of teachers, never gave them anything back. And honestly, I mean, that just went on for years. Even when my daughter was in school and I had to go to parents' teachers' evenings, I wouldn't catch the eye of the teacher because I found teachers so monstrous. And my daughter had to run the meetings and tell me what to say. So I'm hoping that I'm getting through that now. But that was my entire childhood and schoolhood, was my friends and nothing else. No adult influence at all. I just wasn't interested in what any adult had to bring to the party. I thought I was having a great time, and the longer I stayed a child, the happier I would be. Still true. Once I became a parent, I learned to at least look at other parents my age, if I, you know, even if I still couldn't face people older than me. And the older I get, the more the people my age are the old people. So I'm doing all right. I'm catching up.
I was a messer in school. I did just enough to scrape by. I had very little interest in it. So I thought it was ridiculous that we should take this seriously. So, yeah, I was a messer at school.
I think in primary school, I was probably... I know that I was trying to be a good boy all the time until my best friend, Gavin Comiskey, asked me, why is it that I'm always so good? And so I started to mess. And I was taken up in front of the class and given a clatter, actually. And weirdly, I became a messer after that.
There was a school play. It was all GAA, and I played some of that. But then we did a school play. My English teacher, Pat Colgan, it was actually A Pound on Demand. It was by Sean O'Casey. And I played the woman who comes into the post office. So I was dressed in drag, in the Christian Brothers, in the 80s, in Drogheda, and I felt an enormous sense of power. The power of theatre, definitely, I felt it in that moment. And they were on my side. All of the pupils got on side with me. So I think that had a huge effect.
Yeah, school was not a place that I enjoyed particularly until I got to secondary school. I had an accident where I lost my eye, and my year, the boys in my year, there's about 120 boys in my year, all were great support to me. And that is where I really discovered drama, because I had been playing rugby. I went to Blackrock College and I had been playing rugby, but I stopped once I lost the eye, and I really pushed into the drama. And there was a tutor there called Turlock O'Brien who really encouraged this thing. And so did all my friends. And there was a lot of bands in my year and all that kind of stuff, you know. Yeah, no, I did have a great year. Brian O'Driscoll was my year. I was mad we played rugby together. And he's like, I love Brian. It's amazing. He's a fabulous person to watch, having known him in school and seeing that that same spirit is on a worldwide stage now. It's a wonderful thing, though. So then my thing changed. I was not an academic student or anything. I was a little bit disruptive, like, and I didn't, you know, I bunked a lot of classes and I was suspended and all the usual stuff, but I wasn't the worst of them, you know. Because you had to be, you didn't want to lose your place in the plays or whatever. And I was really happy to get out of school.
Pretty much everyone I admire is a writer. I think of the word Dickensian as a compliment. So if something is Dickensian, it is great. And whatever the adjective you'd use for Dostoevsky, I love the epic sweep with the fabulous characterisation and stories. So, yeah, it'll always be a writer that I admire most. I'm hugely impressed by Sarah Phelps, who's a British writer who writes pretty much only for television now. And she just wrestles story. And she's so confident. People love acting in her stuff. So, yeah, these are all my heroes.
I'm going to pick the most obvious choice, which is Shakespeare. When I came to Shakespeare after seeing the Macbeth production, it kind of blew my mind, and actually I became interested in the poetry for the first time, and I haven't stopped being interested in Shakespeare. And latterly I worked on a project with the Solstice Art Centre during COVID, where I was artist in residence, and I did a project on Shakespeare, on the sonnets, which are very beautiful. So I spent a lot of time and took a deep dive into those. And lately Dante has kind of taken my interest. So I've taken a deep dive into the Divine Comedy, which is astounding.
I really admire Mick Pyro. I saw him in Whelan's recently, and he's spellbinding anyway. You know, I've seen him throughout his, you know, career. And so it's amazing to watch a man, his energy is just so high and so beautiful and always coming out. And to see that in his present form, is, I think it's like the moving statue. You're like, you're seeing stuff moving that isn't moving because you can feel it. He is just, oh my God. If anybody out there hasn't seen Mick Pyro, you're doing yourself a disservice. Don't go through life without not witnessing that man. He is something special. That's an understatement.
Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. for what he has done for pop music. I think he's changed the form in a way that's enriched everybody involved in pop music. I think he's up there with Beethoven for me in terms of his musical stretch. My two favourite albums would be Pet Sounds and Surf's Up. I think because they're both so different in their execution and the expanse of where they start and where they go to, from pop to lush to orchestral to almost classical. Yeah, I'm not sure if they've been surpassed in popular music. And also the challenges that he had to go through in his life. Yeah, he would be a hero to me.
I think it's very difficult to cope with life if you're not putting a shape on stuff, if you're not saying, I'm somewhere at the beginning of this story and this story is nearing its end and here we are sort of really in the complexity of this story. And life is so confusing that if you can parcel up the story aspects of it, then everything else melts away because the story aspects are gorgeous. They are truly gorgeous. There's nothing like knowing that something is as bad as it can be because the story is telling you that it's going to get a little bit better now, or it can only get better now. It's a great salve to understand the world in stories. I also think I can't understand anything that isn't a story. And it's something that I bring to my work, I think, is just finding the shapes to help make the detail sort of drive home better. If you put it in a good package, the audience might want to listen harder.
What drives me creatively, 100%, no doubt about it, is failure, definitely. Because I fail all the time, constantly. And getting it right has never done anything for me. I've always preferred when I fail. Because failure drives me. It's got a great energy because it's got forward momentum all the time. Because it's like you're always trying to achieve something other than falling down. Well, you just keep tripping up. But you get better and better over time. So, fail again, all that.
Curiosity, the desire to know everything. I think on stage, what drives me most is being present, being truly present in the moment. And that's something that when you have 200, 500, 1,000 people looking at you that you're forced to do, but that's something that I enjoy doing. You can never be as present as that, or I can't anyway.
Greed. I think I want to do as much as I can while I can. I grew up, all the artists that I knew from Maeve through to my own family, through to the people I work with, the ones I admired the most worked the hardest. And I love it. I love it. So it's an appetite for the work, and it's why do 4 things when you can do 5? So yeah, appetite's better than greed, isn't it? Take greed away.
The biggest risk I have ever taken was getting off a train in 1989 with my friend Nettie King. I was going up to repeat my leaving cert. I had done a marketing course for a year and hated it. And Nettie, I spoke to him, I hadn't seen him in a while, and I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was getting off the train to go to this drama course in Bull Alley. So I got off the train with Nettie and I went to the course and I met Neville and I said, I think this might be for me. So he gave me some stuff to prepare. He said, come back next week. I came back next week. I prepared the stuff and I performed it for him and he said, OK, you can start. And that was 3 years of drama school and I'd never looked back. So I would say getting off that train with Nettie was the biggest risk.
I'm so boring around risk. I hate risk. This is why I don't sleep the night before a studio. I try to organise everything in advance. It doesn't mean that I'm not open to new stuff. It just means that in the final analysis, I've got an answer in my back pocket. And I hate risk. I absolutely hate risk. And if I've ever taken a risk, it's gone badly. I know that. And so I am all about the preparation.
The biggest risk I ever took was having a sordid affair. It was absolutely brilliant. It was 6 months of my life with my now baby mama. And it's the best risk I ever took. Yeah, I was I was in a very comfortable place in my life, I think, and I jumped ship. It was class. That 6 months was very special, and is probably the reason why my children are here.
I think the period of time that would have affected me most would have been the birth of my children, which were 2006, 2008, and also the death of my parents, which they both passed away in 2009. And both of my parents held out to pass away on a Sunday. So it was the only time I could actually be present. So I was actually present. And I have a feeling that they held out for that. I was doing, when my mother passed away, I was doing a solemn mass for a full moon in summer. It was about a character grieving. And I felt that I was using my work to work through my grieving in real life. And when my father passed away, I was doing All My Sons in the Gate.
The period of my life that most affected my work is definitely the birth of my children. Same as everybody else. They change you forever. I think you have to face certain things in yourself and who you are, and you start making decisions not based solely on what it is you want, but on your love for your children. You know, jobs that I may have said no to before, I do for, you know, sometimes for the money. And then when I get to do a job that's of artistic value, that's to nourish the mind normally, and like if there's no money involved, that's for the mind and you need that. So it's trying to find this balance where before it used to be all the decisions were made in such a casual way. Now I have to really think about it.
And there you heard the voices of director Jessica Drumgoole and actors Tadhg Murphy and Ronan Leahy talking about working on The Last Room by J.P. McMahon. The play, which took third prize at the 2024 PJ O'Connor Awards and is next week's Drama on One. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds.
Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.